Amy Herman, editor of Physicians First Watch, offers a capsule of the week's most important medical news. And from there, we go on to chat with Dr. Laura Hawkes about her study of forced sexual initiation and its aftermath. Here's the news.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. The FDA has approved oral semaglutide to treat adults with type 2 diabetes. The drug, which will be sold under the brand name Rybelsus, is the first glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist approved in the U.S. that does not need to be injected. It's intended to be used along with diet and exercise. Next, high-risk patients who undergo percutaneous coronary intervention, or PCI, and take dual antiplatelet therapy may fare better if they stop the aspirin early. Patients who took ticagrelor plus aspirin and then replaced the aspirin with a placebo after 3 months had less bleeding than patients who continued aspirin, and this did not come at the expense of more cardiovascular events. Elsewhere, a study supports high-intensity surveillance after colorectal adenomas are removed during cancer screening. In particular, 3-year surveillance after removing high-risk adenomas and 5-year surveillance after removing low-risk ones seems reasonable. Our next story is for the nut lovers out there. A large study finds that eating more nuts is associated with less weight gain over time. It's also associated with lower odds of becoming obese. Just note that it was an observational study, and some of the researchers have ties to the nut industry. And we'll end with some drug recall news. 14 lots of prescription ranitidine are being recalled because of increased levels of NDMA, which is a probable human carcinogen. And more losartan is being recalled because of too high NMBA, which is a possible carcinogen. And that's it for this week. Now, onto Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
This week, we chat with Laura Hawkes, first author on a paper exploring the circumstances and medium-term health outcomes of forced sexual initiation in a sample of U.S. women. When the paper was published last week in JAMA Internal Medicine, headlines in the press pretty consistently repeated the finding that between 6 and 7% of U.S. women, or about 1 in every 15, experienced a sexual initiation, that is, vaginal intercourse, that was forced or coerced. She's kindly agreed to discuss her finding with us. Dr. Hawkes is a member of the Department of Medicine at the Cambridge Health Alliance and a research fellow at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Hawkes.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You know, the term forced sexual initiation sounds like something from anthropology. I was thinking of Margaret Mead and things. But wouldn't it be clearer to call it rape?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And I completely understand that it has created some discomfort among the audience, both the lay audience and the clinical audience reading the study. Our intention with using that term is that it's consistent with other studies which have published about rape at first sexual encounter or forced sexual initiation, mm-hmm. Both internationally and also in the United States, although the literature in the United States has been very limited. And from a clinical standpoint, our perspective was that calling that forced sex is very synonymous with rape. We had no intention of diluting the concept.
But it made people think of, okay, so what is it exactly that they're saying?
Yeah, so I think the other point for us to be clear is that none of the exposed cases in our study are examples of sexual assault. They are all rape. So the actual wording of the question was, would you say that your first vaginal intercourse was voluntary or non-voluntary? That is, did you choose to have sex of your own free will or not? It's quite well defined that anybody in that category who's saying my first sexual encounter was not voluntary, it was not of my own volition, is somebody who had a non-consensual penetrative sexual encounter. So all of the cases in our study would be considered legally defined as rape, as defined by the woman as a non-consensual sexual encounter.
Okay. So that also then, though that's interesting, so that includes those cases in which the boyfriend says to the girlfriend, well, you know, if we don't have sex, then our relationship is over.
Yeah. And so that is really the key variable here is whether or not the woman identified it as a consensual encounter.
Okay.
So All of the women who answered the question, my first sexual encounter was involuntary or forced, asked a series of questions about how it was forced. And the word that we used in the study was how it was coerced. But I do think that has created a little bit of confusion in the readership about whether or not this was forced or coerced sex. But it was all forced sex in our exposed category in our particular study.
And you used federal data. This was a federal questionnaire that was conducted, and you and your co-authors did not do any of the interviewing or anything like that. You used existing data.
Exactly. So the CDC conducts a study in two-year cycles called the National Survey of Family Growth. It's a study that looks at family patterns, desires to childbear, previous childbearing experiences, childhood experiences, who you live with, what you do for a living, a lot of socioeconomic variables. And one of the questions in that survey are these questions about forced sex or involuntary sex.
Okay. And The question about forced or involuntary sex was not asked of women under the age of 18.
It was not asked of women under the age of 18.
Okay, so we'll get back to that to that issue later in this mm-hmm. interview, but it's an interesting one. There were something like 13,000 women of reproductive age in the sample. And you expanded that out, you know, taking that as a valid sample. You say that across the United States, there would be some
3 million.
Yeah, 3 million women.
3.3.
3.3 million women who would have experienced forced sexual initiation.
So I guess I should just explain to the listeners that the national government runs a wide range of federally funded, nationally represented surveys. So these are experienced statisticians and methodologists who are able to execute these studies and then apply weighting variables in a way such that the results can then be generalized to a sample of the United States, of the entire country.
One thing that caught my eye was the disparity in age between the male partner or assaulter and these are the average ages. So the average age of the male, I want to say perpetrator, it was about 12 years older than the woman. Right.
Yeah. So in regards to the age, there were a couple of sort of alarming statistics. The first was how young the women were who experienced forced sexual initiation. They were on average about 15 years old, a little over older than 15 years old. So they were really girls at the time, on average, that they experienced the assault. The difference between women who had forced involuntary sexual initiation was almost 2 years. So women who chose to have their first sexual encounter were about 2 years older at the time that they chose to have sex. And then the third discrepancy or sort of alarming statistic was that discrepancy in age. So the average age of what we refer to as an assailant in the study was 27 years old. So it was about 12 years, 11 to 12 years, the age difference between the two. So it was pretty jarring. As a comparison, in the voluntary sexual initiation group, the age was 21. So the male was still a bit older, but it was only about 4 years.
About 4 years, yeah. And I thought, boy, that's a kind of an indication that it could have been a family member. Or even a parent, because of that, that's a rather large jump.
Yeah, and we were not able in our study to identify anything else about the relationship between the victim and the assailant.
Over half of the pressure exerted was not physical, it was verbal. It was this bad negotiation. I don't know whether you'd call it a negotiation or whether you'd call it the verbal assault, but That was a rather large number, I thought.
Yeah, so I think a couple of important points to bring out. In that series of questions, the responses were not mutually exclusive, so respondents could respond to more than one. So just because they reported having experienced verbal pressure does not mean they were not also held down.
Okay.
Or they were not also, you know, exposed to some physical threat, or they were not given the drug. There were a couple of different other options there. But certainly I don't say that to minimize the fact that a woman can be forced into sex against her will using verbal pressure alone. And one of the sort of most identifiable risk factors that we know of is that the average age difference between these women was and their assailant was 12 years. So we're talking about right off the bat a huge power discrepancy and presumably a major size discrepancy as well. Yeah. So when you sort of get that context, understanding that physical violence isn't always necessary to conduct a rape, I think it's extremely important because, you know, we didn't differentiate in our analyses differences in how the types of coercion. So these outcomes were found among all the women who identified their first sexual encounter as rape.
And it's important to remember, for the listener and for the readers of your paper, that you are looking at initiation, sexual initiation, not at lifetime sexual experiences, because there are plenty of other opportunities for bad things to happen through one's life. But you are just examining the sexual initiation and its medical sequelae.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Medical associations. It's not a causal study. Right. So the most accurate term would be medical associations.
Okay. And so you found that it was the association was with four adverse outcomes. So some of them were more associated than others. For instance, never using birth control, they were 2.2. The odds ratio was 2.2 times as likely as the women who did not experience force initiation. And then the other three were unwanted first pregnancy. The odds ratio there was 1.8. Pelvic inflammatory disease as a down the road, that was one, the odds ratio was 1.8 again. And then problems with ovulation or menstruation, 1.7. So these are real medical, not sequelae, but they are, as you said, associations.
Yeah.
That's a strong association, isn't it?
Yeah. So we found a pretty strong and consistent association, and how we sort of broke it up into category was obstetric or birth related outcomes and then reproductive outcomes. And then we had some sort of general health quality of life measures as well. So under the reproductive health outcomes, that's where we saw the lower age at first pregnancy, the increased likelihood of having an undesired first pregnancy, increased rates of abortion. And, that may the sort of causal explanation between having a first sexual encounter be rape and then having less control over your reproductive health is that it's an extremely disempowering experience for women to have their very first sexual encounter be a rape where they have no control over what happened, and that it may sort of create a loss of autonomy over their sexual behavior in the future. And again, this is not something that happened to everybody. The absolute numbers were certainly not 100%, but it was something that was more strongly associated in the group that had forced sexual initiation. The other category that we looked at, the gynecologic conditions, were the where we consistently saw the association was conditions that are going to initially present as chronic pelvic pain. So endometriosis, pelvic inflammatory disease, and problems with ovulation and menstruation are all going to, one of the most common presenting complaints is going to be pelvic pain. And so the suggestion there is that, as we know with physical and sexual trauma, there has been association with pain, painful conditions in other studies. So it is suggestive that one sort of causal mechanism here is that this traumatic sexual experience early in life is manifesting itself as pelvic pain in the future.
And so you mentioned that practicing clinicians are likely to see several patients a week who've experienced forced sexual initiation. Now, the questionnaire did not ask young women about this, about the circumstances of their initiation. What do you hope that clinicians who see someone, say, at the age of 16, with indications of pelvic inflammatory disease, what do you hope will happen in the interaction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that I have thought a lot about recently since working on this paper and talking about it a lot is sort of where the role of a universal screen comes in versus some sort of understanding by the doctor that he or she are seeing risk factors and should sort of probe more in that direction of asking about sexual violence. So I think it just needs to be something that is prominently on the mind of doctors who take care of women, especially young women, to consider that sexual violence is very, very common and that it probably does have a wide range of clinical consequences and that it's something that is worth discussing in an extremely sensitive and cautious manner with your patients. But it's also important that if we're going to be bringing something like sexual violence up with the patient, that we have the resources available should you uncover a case of sexual violence. So I know, obviously, in a lot of practices, particularly in underserved area, mental health care is extremely hard to come by. So sort of doing what we can to make sure that when we encounter someone who's experienced trauma, we have sort of some behavioral health options to back that up.
So the way to address this is this also exists in the realm of public health and an investment in the society and in the infrastructure of the society and having these things available and having a society in which these things can happen. And I wonder if you thought about the question of, okay, so this is, we're looking at the victims of men behaving badly.
Yeah.
What can we do? What's possible to be done to address that? And are there studies of rapists that are informative that you've encountered?
My answer to that question is pretty broad, and I don't have any very specific interventions. But you know, I think when we talk about sexual violence, the vast majority of the time, it is an expression of power, and power needs to be expressed in societies where there are a lot of inequalities. So truly, to minimize sexual violence in our society, we have to be much more intentional and proactive about creating equality between men and women in our society. And I think that we are learning, you know, although we've made great strides in the professional sphere and in education and improving the access to those spaces among women, we're still really, really far behind. And you know, the Time's Up movement, and there's a big Time's Up healthcare movement, have been very prominent in vocalizing a lot of the statistics showing the inequality that persists in workspaces. And it also persists in universities, and it also persists in education. This is all learned behavior, or early education. You know, this is all learned behavior that is starting young and going through life. So while we have made great strides, we have a lot further to go. And at first glance, it may seem that sexual equality or gender equality is not at all related to the issue of sexual violence. But sort of when you understand it as an expression of power, I think it makes a lot more sense to connect the two.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hawks, for talking with me about this very complicated problem.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
That was our 235th episode. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.